Hello, I'm Fred Stella, President of Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. I was perusing the Grand Rapids Press recently and came across an article about an incident you may be aware of. An art collector retrofitted some Nike sneakers as Satan shoes, decorating them with pentagrams, including a drop of human blood in the red coloring, and selling them for over a grand a pair. Oh, and he only manufactured 666 pair. In the article, Dr. Joseph Laycock is quoted. He's the author of the book Speak of the Devil, How the Satanic Temple is Changing How We Talk About Religion. And it hit me then that in the almost quarter century that we've been yapping into this microphone, we have never investigated that frightful figure who has been a part of Western theology, mythology, some of the greatest literature ever written, cartoons, Twilight Zones, Hollywood, etc. The list goes on. So I think it's time we give the devil his due today, as we invite Dr. Laycock to join us for a conversation on how the archangel became the dark angel, and also how Christians, Jews, and Muslims have responded to him. Our guest, Joseph Laycock, is an assistant professor of religious studies at Texas State University. He has written several books on new religious movements and American religious history. He is also a co-editor for the journal Nova Religio. Some of his books include Vampirism, Modern Vampires and Embattled Identity Claims, Dangerous Games, What the Moral Panic Over Role-Playing Games Says About Play, Religion, and Imagined Worlds, The Seer of Bayside, Veronica Lukin, A Marian Apparition and the Struggle to Define Catholic Tradition, Unmasking the Alien Deception, Why Evangelicals Are Studying Ufology. So we welcome to Common Threads, Joseph Laycock. Hello, Joe.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Certainly, certainly. So I think the first question should be, who is Satan? And I know that there are probably several answers to that. So in tackling this monstrous first question, part of that would be, do you think if we gathered all of the authors of the Bible together, of course now we'd have to do it by Zoom, would we hear from them that they had different understandings? Would there be any disagreement? And also, how did Paradise Lost add to who Satan is? So there's a good first question for you.
Yeah, that's a big question. So historians of the Bible assume that the authors of the Bible would almost certainly not be on the same page about who this figure is. And so in the Hebrew Bible, also known as the Old Testament, Satan's almost not in that book at all. And a lot of Christians would say, well, what are you talking about? Who tempts Eve to eat the apple? If you read the Genesis story, though, it says the serpent was the cleverest of all the wild animals. It does not say a fallen angel turned itself into a serpent in order to trick people. So that is an interpretation of the text. Where we see Satan the most in the Old Testament is in the book of Job. And in that story, of course, Satan sort of challenges God to a bet, right, about how far he can push people before they will lose faith in God. But in that story, Satan appears to be part of a court of angels. And Satan arrives in heaven to, you know, have this bet with God. And God doesn't seem to think that this is unusual, that Satan's here in heaven. So at least in the book of Job, it seems that Satan was understood as an angel who is loyal to God but doesn't like human beings very much. And, of course, the word Satan means something like accuser. So almost in the sense of a judge in a trial will have a prosecuting attorney whose job is to prove the person is guilty. Now, by the time of the New Testament, this had changed. And the historians think there could be several reasons for that. One of them is the influence of the Greeks and the influence of a Persian religion called Zoroastrianism, which has ideas of a god of evil and a god of good. But Satan becomes necessary in the New Testament because if you're going to say that God is not only all-powerful and controls everything, but is also a nice person who loves us, whereas in the Old Testament, God is often not very nice, now we need something else to explain that. And so Satan becomes a figure who's not only an enemy of humanity, but also an enemy of God. And we don't know exactly when this story of an archangel who rebels against God and falls from heaven begins. The passage on the shoes, the satanic shoes, has a passage from Luke that says, "I saw Satan fall like lightning," which would imply that by the time the Gospels were written, this was already a well-known story. And then in the second and third centuries, Christians begin looking back to the Old Testament and trying to find evidence of the story in the text. So the serpent becomes interpreted as Satan, and other figures in the Old Testament like Leviathan and Behemoth, who appear to just be kind of giant mythological monster-type creatures, also get interpreted as being the presence of Satan. And Paradise Lost really tried to flesh out the story of a rebellion against God and to make an epic text, right? So Milton wanted to write something similar to the Iliad for Christians. And in doing so, Satan had to become at least a little bit of a sympathetic villain, right? Because just a sort of a one-dimensional, pure evil character, it doesn't make for very interesting reading. So Milton sort of made Satan into a figure who was kind of misguided. And in doing so, he set the stage for totally rereading Satan, not as an evil character, but one that is kind of a tragic anti-hero, right? And someone who is, if nothing else, brave and sticking to their guns, even in the face of overwhelming odds. So this set the stage for people actually sympathizing with Satan.
And is the name Lucifer entirely synonymous with Satan? How did that name come about?
Well, when they were early Christians were looking for evidence of Satan, in the Hebrew Bible, they found a passage referring to a character called the Morning Star, and basically a kind of taunt of, "Look how the Morning Star has fallen." Historians of the Bible are not sure what this meant in its original context. A lot of people think that Morning Star would have been an epithet for a neighboring kingdom like Tyre, right? So sort of, you thought you were better than Israel, and you got your comeuppance, and now you have fallen. And if you read it in context, it does not appear to be talking about an archangel rebelling against God or something like this. But that term Morning Star becomes the basis as the Hebrew Bible is translated from Hebrew and then into Greek and then into Latin of that name Lucifer. So Lucifer has the meaning of a light bearer.
You say that in the beginning of the book that it took you longer to write this book than previous books. Why is that?
Well, my book, Speak of the Devil, is not about the devil per se. It's about a group called the Satanic Temple. And it's a very active group, and they seem to be doing something every week. And it was just very hard for me to keep track of all of their comings and goings. And I finally set up a Google News alert for the word satanic. And every morning I would log in and I would get all of the world's tidings related to all things satanic. And so it was sort of, you know, just this constant moving target or this constant treadmill of trying to stay on top of something. You know, in most people in religious studies, we look at texts or cultures that died out hundreds of years ago. And in some ways, that's much easier than studying things that are happening right now.
That makes a lot of sense. So Satan worship, what we call Satan worship, isn't really necessarily Satan worship in the way. There are not a lot of people gathering at a church or a temple and bowing down to a statue and chanting incantations and actually believing that there is this dark figure that rules the netherworld, right? That's sort of a cartoon version. Tell us what most people who claim to be Satanists really are.
Right. So the word Satanism is confusing because for most of the history of the word, as far as we could tell, there were no actual Satanists. It was something that you always accused other people of. And this word appears for the first time after the Protestant Reformation. So in Europe, for the first time, you have two rival churches, and they each begin accusing the other of, well, you're not really a Christian, you're actually a Satanist. And then, you know, legends begin to form about what Satanists are like and what they do and so forth. But there's very little evidence that anybody actually was a Satanist. And that changed in 1966 with a man named Anton LaVey in San Francisco, who founded the Church of Satan and openly stated, I am a Satanist. But LaVey was an atheist. He didn't believe in God or Satan. For him, this was a bit more like, you know, performance art or something like this, or psychotherapy. And so he and his friends would hold black masses, which he said were, he admitted were inspired by, you know, Hollywood movies with depictions of what Satanists do. And he said, well, we do this because we're kind of trying to decondition ourselves from our Christian upbringing, right? We were taught to be deferential to the authority of church figures. And so when we do this, we don't think that any supernatural forces are actually listening to us, but it kind of, it's training ourselves that we're free and we can do what we want. And besides that, it's lots of fun. So Anton LaVey would have been called a non-theistic Satanist. He did not believe in the supernatural, but he still thought ritual and symbolism were important and even part of being kind of a healthy, well-rounded human being. And the Satanic Temple, in some ways, is similar to the Church of Satan. They also say, we don't believe in a literal Satan. Satan is basically our favorite fictional character. And, of course, this is the Satan of the Romantics, a kind of tragic rebel figure, not the Satan who is an enemy of humanity. Now, there are some people who identify as Satanists who are sometimes called esoteric or theistic Satanists who actually believe that supernatural forces are real, right? And that there is a kind of dark side to the supernatural, and that when they do rituals, they're kind of tapping into that in one way or another. But that's definitely the minority of people who would describe themselves as Satanists.
Now, the word may not have been used way back when, but throughout the medieval period and in early America, you had people who were accused of being witches, and they were, part of that accusation was that they were in league with the devil to some degree. Is that correct?
That's right. By the early modern period, so again, this is the aftermath of the Protestant Reformation. That is the period where you have witch trials and claims of demonic possession and accusations of Satanism. And the understanding was that God has limited Satan's power. And so Satan can only really do supernatural things in the world if he has entered a contract with a human being. And so that's what witches were understood to be in early modern Europe. These were people who had entered a contract with the demon, and in exchange, the demon was allowed to work things on Earth.
And so if somebody was a theistic Satanist, I'm trying to wrap my head around this, because in fiction I have seen, well, for instance, Faust. Wouldn't Faust have been considered a Satanist? That is to say, he believed in God and he believed in the devil, and he was willing to sell his soul. He was willing to make a deal with the devil that he would have a good life here on earth, fully knowing that in the afterlife he would be tormented for all eternity. Is that close enough?
Yeah, I think you could fairly describe the Faust legend as a legend of a Satanist, right? Of someone who has made this contract with the devil, right? But the important thing to understand historically is it's a legend, right? This is sort of an imagination of what someone else somewhere in the world might be like, not a real person.
Right. So I'm saying, I want to be clear, to your best understanding, there are no people like that. At least you don't know about them.
Yeah, I have met a group called the Temple of Set. It's broke away from the Church of Satan in the 1970s. And their claim was, well, we disagree that when we do all these rituals, nothing is happening. We think that there is some sort of entity out there that is noticing us. And they came to believe that what the Bible refers to as Satan is not a biblical character at all, that it is the Egyptian god Set. And their claim is that Set wants to kind of accelerate human evolution and sort of, you know, get better or perish kind of idea. And so Set is frightening, but not necessarily evil in the way that Christianity understands Satan to be. So it's very hard to find people who actually say, you know, Satan is what Christianity says Satan is. And is a force of evil and is destined to lose, and I'm going to worship him anyway.
Right.
It's hard to find somebody that fits that bill. Someone like Richard Ramirez, the serial killer, might fit the bill. But we're talking about a very rare class of people here.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is Joseph Laycock. He is the author of the book Speak of the Devil, How the Satanic Temple is Changing How We Talk About Religion. So, I believe, according to your book, one of the real motivators of the temple is the Ten Commandments case in Oklahoma and other states as well. And I do remember the news from back then, but why don't you summarize the situation for us?
Sure. So it's a complicated case, and reporting on it hasn't been very good. But here in Austin, Texas, a few miles from where I now sit, we have a Ten Commandments monument on the state capitol, and someone filed a case claiming this is a violation of the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment of the Constitution, that if a building where the state of Texas makes its laws has a religious symbol on it, this is sending a clear message that our laws are going to favor Christians, and other religions are kind of, you know, not as welcome in the state of Texas. And the Ten Commandments, of course, the Ten Commandments actually has slightly different versions for Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, because in the original text, it's not clear where one commandment ends and the other one begins, and it is the Protestant version that is in all these monuments. And this case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that the Ten Commandments monument in the state of Texas was okay because there were lots of other monuments on the grounds to lots of other things that were important to Texas, and this meant it had a different message than if it was the only monuments on the Capitol grounds. And lawyers who have looked at these kinds of cases have said this makes the Supreme Court more like interior decorators, right, than arbiters of constitutional law. So Oklahoma, a few years ago, decided, well, if Texas has one, we want one too. And so they wrote a bill saying that we're going to make this Ten Commandments monument, and we will have other monuments later so that we will have a situation like Texas. And it was at this moment that the Satanic Temple swooped in and basically said, we heard you guys are looking for monuments. Have we got a monument for you? If you put up this monument of Baphomet, basically the devil, nobody can claim that you guys are only endorsing Christianity. And in your Ten Commandments monument will be totally constitutionally viable. And everyone thought that this was a joke, but that statue actually got built and has been looking for a home ever since.
So what was the final ruling? Why isn't that statue on the Oklahoma grounds, state grounds?
Right. Well, the person to actually sue and claim it was unconstitutional was a Baptist pastor. And I think a lot of people don't understand that, but there are lots of Christians who would say the separation of church and state is not only good for the state, it's good for the church, right? This keeps the government from sort of appropriating Christianity. So this lawsuit was filed, and the Oklahoma state constitution is actually pretty clear that government resources cannot be used for religious purposes. And the Oklahoma Supreme Court said, yeah, this is a clear violation, this monument has got to go. And so in some ways, the Satanic Temple had nothing to do with the removal of that monument. However, there were people in Oklahoma who said, well, if our state constitution is an obstacle, let's just change the constitution. Let's just take that clause out so that we can use government resources for religious purposes. And it was at that point that somebody said,
wait a second, what about those Satanist guys? Are they going to come back? If we change the Constitution, wouldn't that mean that someday, you know, the Satanists could put something up on a government building? And so even though they didn't affect the case directly, I think they changed slightly the way people think about these issues.
So tell us, what happened to the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey's invention, and how did the Temple of Satan, the Satanic Temple, how did that become the go-to organization for Satanists?
Sure. So the Church of Satan is still around, and it had kind of a heyday in the late 60s and early 70s, and for a while I think they had considered making sort of little communities of Satanists that they were going to call grottos in every state in America. But Anton LaVey was sort of a misanthropic, antisocial guy. I don't think that he had the kind of interest or the personality to really make this into a full-blown church. And so the Church of Satan basically says, you know, Satanists should keep to themselves, right? We are kind of smarter and better than the normal people, and we don't need to get involved in politics, and we don't need to form big organizations, and that's sort of not what this is about. And the Church of Satan is also politically pretty conservative. So Anton LaVey was a big fan of Ayn Rand and her philosophy of objectivism, and basically everybody needs to pay their own way, and the government shouldn't provide anyone welfare and things like this. So the Satanic Temple formed much later. They began to form in 2012. And one of their members, Lucian Greaves, had been a member of the Church of Satan, but was frustrated that the Church of Satan didn't really do very much. They didn't meet very often. They weren't active. And he felt, what's the point of having a satanic organization if we're not going to organize and we're not going to do anything? And so the Satanic Temple formed, you know, with the intention of having these kinds of political, I would call them provocations. Other people might even call them pranks, right? But doing things like offering to build a statue for the state of Oklahoma to kind of force their, you know, conversation about their ideas about the separation of church and state. And not long after that, statue began to make the rounds on the internet because it was sort of a quirky little story that lots of people were reporting on. There were people all over America who were kind of sympathetic to the idea of Satanism, but they couldn't be part of a satanic organization because there wasn't really anything around. And they saw this and they said, I want to get involved. And so very rapidly, the Satanic Temple grew from a handful of people in Boston kind of doing these very elaborate political stunts to being a full-blown religion with chapters all over the United States and abroad.
When one thinks of Satanism, one of the stereotypes that comes to mind, at least to me, is unbridled hedonism. And from what I gather in your book, certainly the Satanic Temple does not thrive on that. How about the Church of Satan? Was that a pretty wild bunch?
The Church of Satan are very proud hedonists. And in their heyday in San Francisco, they had pretty epic parties. I wasn't there, but people like Sammy Davis Jr. became members of the Church of Satan just for the parties. And this was, you know, very transgressive. They would famously have nude women who would serve as an altar when they did satanic rituals. This is another trope that they picked up from, you know, horror movies and novels and things like this. And they had kind of a philosophy of hedonism, right? And they said that Christianity teaches you to repress all of your instincts and your natural desire to pursue pleasure, and that's actually unhealthy, right? That if you bottle up your desires, they come out in unhealthy ways, and that Satanism, where those desires are expressed naturally, is a better way to do this. And the Church of Satan was one of the first churches to kind of openly support gay people in San Francisco and things like that. Right? They said if you have a desire for same-sex relations, you should pursue that, right, and sort of see where that goes. The Satanic Temple is really interested in changing society. They're not really interested in, you know, is the church stopping us from having a great party or things like this. They also like to party. You know, they have social events and they have parties to celebrate things. But their goals are really about making changes in society that they feel are important. So that would include things like the separation of church and state, issues of reproductive rights, stopping corporal punishments in public schools. And to them, that's what really matters, right? Pursuing pleasure is just really not part of their platform.
Well, Joseph, this has been fascinating, and I have many more questions for you. We're down to the wire for this episode of Common Threads, but we're hoping you can join us next week and we can continue.
I'm looking forward to it.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. My name is Fred Stella, and today we've been speaking with Joseph Laycock. He is the author of Speak of the Devil, How the Satanic Temple is Changing the Way We Talk About Religion. Please join us next week here on WGVU.